Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Delancey. Today I'm joined by Leclerc Laberge, who is the author of Wages Against Artwork, Decommodified Labor and the Claims of Socially Engaged Art, which was published by Duke University Press in 2019. Before we begin, I have to make a little spoiler in the form of a note for our listeners who came across this episode on the Animal Studies channel. This is not a mistake. If you'd like to skip straight to the second half of our conversation, where we'll be talking about the role of animals in contemporary art, I'll include a timestamp in the show description. With that out of the way, welcome to the show, Leclerc.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us. So in Wages Against Artwork, you look at a phenomenon of artistic labor that is becoming divorced from traditional forms of pay, that is, from wages. Artistic education, much in line with other university education, is increasingly seen as an investment, but the terms of return on such investment are not necessarily clear. The pandemic has highlighted some of these issues, but they have been playing out in the art academy and in art institutions since the 1970s, particularly under the auspices of socially engaged art. I'd like to start by asking you about how your interests in this field have developed, given that you previously engaged with a very different kind of an industry.
Yeah, my previous book was called Scandals and Abstraction, Financial Fiction of the 1980s. And I wrote it, let's say, between 2006 and 2012. So during both the sort of height of financial leveraging and speculation in the United States, and then in the sort of depths of the despair of the what has come to be called the Great Recession. And by 2012, I was living in New York City, and I was seeing the sort of post Great Recession world emerge, in which there were new popular and cultural claims on what a political economy is and could be, and who could produce knowledge about it, who could critique it, how it should be represented. And those were the kind of claims that in my first book, Scandals and Abstraction, I had dealt with looking at very canonical 1980s literature, things like The Bonfire of the Vanities or American Psycho. And working with canonical texts has its own possibilities. There's a lot of criticism about them that an author can use, but it also has limits. For example, it's much harder to talk to or get an interview with somebody like, Don DeLillo or Bret Easton Ellis than it is a contemporary artist. And in 2012, after Occupy Wall Street, a collaborator of mine asked if I would be interested in doing a show about artists in debt. She was then working at the Elizabeth Foundation for the Arts, which is a contemporary art center in New York City. And she felt that in the wake of Occupy Wall Street, there was sort of an incredible conversation germinating amongst artists about what it meant to live and work as an artist. And it was then that I started to notice that the operative sort of idiom or language that artists were using to talk about their own economic conditions was not something like finance or financialization or leveraging or securitization, but was really about labor and debt. And so when we started to curate this show that opened in 2012, it was called To Have and To Owe. I think it was one of the first shows actually to really look at the relationship between arts production and indebtedness. We got a wonderful sort of reception, but it also alerted me to the fact that as a scholar who works on the relationship between economics and culture broadly defined, there was an opportunity to sort of capture and engage a different level of that relationship. So now it wouldn't be between sort of popular literature, canonical literature, and finance. Rather, it would be between emergent artistic production and an emergent conversation about the economy in which that participated, which was, in the words in 2012, 2013, it was debt, and there was a group that came out of Occupy Wall Street called Arts and Labor. So somewhat, there was also a conversation about labor. But I wasn't trained as an art historian. I was trained as a literary critic. And so I was quite new to that scene. So I was very lucky that through curating that show, I was introduced to the work of a lot of people, people like Caroline Woolard, Cassie Thornton, Caitlin Berrigan, who wasn't in the show, but who I ended up meeting through the show and writing about. And they were actually quite interested as artists to develop a relationship with critics who could highlight and sort of broaden this aspect of their engagement. So in a certain way, it was kind of an organic synthesis, being in the right place in the right time. In a little bit of a more abstract way, I see it as a continuation of my work on political economy, which is what is the relationship between a given historical moment's economic formation and the cultural residues and products that seek to both sort of capture and critique that moment? And what is the sort of intercourse? What is the sort of back and forth between these two somewhat disparate realms of social life?
Well, being at the right place at the right time does seem to be the origin story of much great research and great writing. And I'll mention for our listeners that you, in fact, spoke about your book Scandals and Abstraction on a previous episode of the podcast. And I'll put a link to that in the show description. What I think is intriguing, both in that work's treatment of the finance industries and now in your treatment of a particular segment of the art world in Wages Against Artwork, is your disciplinary approach, which you bring from literary critique. With that in mind, I wonder if you could introduce the idea of decommodified labor, which you bring straight out with your title.
Absolutely. And I'm going to do that in two ways. One, I'm going to do it in a sort of empirical register. And then secondly, I'll do it in a more sort of critical theoretical register. So in an empirical register, and I should note for listeners that the book mostly, not wholly, but mostly takes place in the United States. The artists work in the United States, or they are American, or they cross through the United States. So this empirical history that I'm going to offer is very much United States dependent, although I think it no doubt has some parallels probably in the UK and Canada, I think less so in continental Europe.
Oh, it certainly does. And not only in the mapping of a parallel or perhaps a precedent history, but with some of the case studies that I think we'll talk about in a moment, it helps to abstract some of the ideas such as student debt that in a European context haven't quite yet played out at the same scale.
So the book, Wages Against Artwork, it opens in the sort of moment of the late 1950s, early 1960s, where the potential of the American equivalent of a sort of welfare state, a sort of Keynesian organized state that can spend and that can create robust public institutions is beginning and is sort of reaching its height. And one of the effects of this in the United States by the mid-1960s, early 1970s, was the creation of huge numbers of arts funding institutions that would be at both the federal level and the state level, particularly in states like New York that have big artist population, but also the birthing of huge numbers of art programs for artist practitioners in the university. And again, this is nationwide, right? The number of students attending university had expanded, the number of universities had expanded, and now the number of arts programs had expanded. So this is really a moment, both these granting agencies and the expansion of these universities, that I would call the commodification of artistic labor, or the setting the scene for the ability of artists to commodify their labor. And we need to get our terms straight in the sense that, you know, commodification is often rightly, but seen as a pejorative word, right? But at the same time, if you're living in a capitalist society, it's important for you to be able to sell your labor, right? That's how one lives. That's how one gets from one day to the next. So the book opens with this scene of mid-1960s census, you have over a million people in the United States claiming artist as a career on the census form, right? But already by the 1970s, this expansionary moment of American liquidity has started to be a little bit truncated. And you start to hear about in universities concerns with, well, you know, we're creating this generation of university credentialed artists. I mean, that's new in its own right, right? If you look at the history of arts discourse, since when do you need to have a credential to be an artist? But we're creating this whole sort of cohort of credentialed artists, and we're not yet sure where they're going to go, right? So this is a question that starts to emerge in the 1970s, but precisely because of the historical moment in which this is written, you don't yet have massive forms of student debt, right? You still have sort of robust granting agencies. But you can see that the scene is already sort of being set for the production of artists without the production of employment structures for them to flourish in, right? And really, one of the main employment structures is going to come to be the university, which is the same place they got their degree, right, and went into debt. And now that's the place that they're hoping to get back into. And so this turns into a whole sort of pyramid scheme of capital. But what I was trying to do is look at what this history, this empirical history, what it could offer not only to artists and to art historical discourses, but to critical theoretical and Marxist conceptions of labor. And, you know, in the last maybe 10, 15 years, we've also had a proliferation of attempts to define what labor is in our contemporary moment, right? So you get terms sort of like, let's say, cognitive labor or digital labor or emotional labor or affective labor. And one can go on with these, and all of these terms are trying to register a quality of a changed labor in a 21st century developed capitalist economy in the global north. And what I started to wonder is what is the term for people who are highly trained, highly skilled laborers, except they have no place to sell their labor. And I think you could apply this to a lot of different populations. But what's unique, and what I realized what's unique in the socially engaged art world, is that artists all over the United States were starting to produce as their art sort of pseudo-employment situations in which they could be professionalized as artists, as art, but without the wage.
Well, a pyramid scheme is definitely an indictment. Well, I guess what you're describing is a situation in which the rerouting of artistic training into universities was exactly what heralded all the ways of thinking and experiencing the problems of labor that we are contending with in today's capitalism, and that in this situation, art, having found itself in the conditions of precarity and so on, of competition and employment, it participates in attempts to undo some of the problems which it has contributed to bringing about.
Well, it creates the problem and resolves it in what Althusser would say is an ideological way, which is sort of an imaginary way, right? It offers artists a chance to present and resolve this problem, but the absolute resolution of the problem would be for them to get a wage, and that it doesn't offer, right? And so it takes on the quality of a kind of ghostly representational economy in which you have these socially engaged artists making institutions, galleries, exchange networks, barter networks, sort of quasi-employment relations, many of which mimic a welfare state as art, but doing so without a wage. And the reason that I titled the book as a sort of, tribute to the contradiction that Silvia Federici noted in the 1970s with her essay, Wages Against Artwork, was to say that the wage, the artist's wage in particular, has come to hold this central contradiction of 21st century developed capitalism, where you have an expansion of a group of people who not only are ready and willing and skilled and able to work and don't have the ability to do so, but who are now creating these sort of aesthetic worlds in which they can do so, but still without recompense.
Right. And this is the paradox with which Silvia Federici contended in the context of domestic women's labor.
So I think one of the really important things that Federici diagnosed in the contradictory title of her essay, Wages Against Housework, is that the wage is needed, but it's not enough. It can't get us out of that relationship, right? And so I tried to use that term to really diagnose this moment in arts production, art circulation, art criticism, where those members of that community that are participating in it certainly need wages. People need to be able to reproduce themselves socially. But this whole chapter started in the 1970s by giving them wages, and the wages have slowly disappeared, right? So the contradiction remains that wages are needed and wages are not enough. There has to be a different mechanism of social reproduction put in place to have a different kind of art culture. I don't think we yet know what that is. I think what my book does is it attempts to sort of grasp the contradiction of the wage and its relationship to a certain kind of arts production at this moment in time. But one other thing that I do want to stress is the concept of decommodified labor is I hope, a way to categorize how people work in the present that's not dependent on a technological infrastructure, right? So if you think of a notion like computational labor or digital labor, you have this idea that it's really reflective of an increased age of platform capitalism or a digital age or a computational age. But my reading of Marx and my reading of what technology is at a certain level of abstraction, it's really unchanging, right? And we don't need to have the qualifications of a particular kind of technology, digital, computational, cognitive labor, to denote this contradiction. I think the contradiction that we're now in, particularly in cultural industries, and I'm not just talking about now art, I'm talking about film, I'm talking about television production, I'm talking about sports, which is a huge industry globally, is that you can work as though you were formally employed with all the strictures that a job entails and provides and do so without a wage, right? So you are working, you are working in formal labor, you are subject to the codes of formal labor, but you're unwaged. And that to me is a different and important term. And that's what I meant to qualify and categorize with decommodified labor.
Right. And the range of examples which you cite in the book indicates the phenomenon of unpaid labor is definitely on the rise. Where you recently wrote an article in which you chastise a US university for advertising essentially unpaid jobs, which are passed under the guise of volunteering. And this kind of unwaged work is something that I can attest to is pretty much the norm in the former institutional and commercial art world, let alone in artistic production itself. What I find interesting in your account is that you place this development within the other end of the academy, that is not necessarily in academic employment, but in the study, in student life itself.
Yeah, I mean, the book opens with this question of, you know, what is it that a student does when he or she or they is doing what? Working to be a student, studying to be a student. I mean, the verb will almost give it away. But again, to go back to my sort of empirical history, by the time of the mid 1970s and the beginning of the sort of collapse of the post-war Keynesian order in the United States, you have movements of students both in New York and in Massachusetts who are making the claim, right? What we are doing is labor. It's not only that we should not have to go in debt or not have to pay to be university students. We should be paid to do it, right? They're making the claim the time has come to expand the category of laborer to include student. And so we hold that moment in suspension and then look at the work of Cassie Thornton, who graduates with her MFA in 2012. Who was able to register as her senior thesis project the laboring conditions of what she and her fellow cohort of MFA practitioners were doing. And she makes the claim not that we should be considered workers. I mean, I think that claim is explicit, but she makes the claim what art students are learning to do in an MFA program is to produce indebtedness as a condition of their own education. And she has this, what I think is a very powerful phrase, which is debt is medium, right? So if you think about what a medium is in an art historical context, it's a sort of temporospatial material that allows you to test the bounds of a concept, a materiality, a situation, but it provides the sort of boundedness of the operation that you're going to be working in. So we can think of, you know, film as medium or paint as medium or marble as medium or the plastic arts, whatever it is. And what Thornton says is our medium in the United States in MFA programs is debt. That's what we're learning to do. We're learning how to be in debt and manage debt and see debt and sculpt debt and understand debt. And I found that to be such a sort of powerful claim. And through meeting her and working with her, she was one of the people in the show I mentioned, To Have and To Owe. I also came to realize, and this is a history that Yates McKee, who's a contemporary critic, also touches on in his book, Strike Art. But that many of the people who organized Occupy Wall Street and who were able to produce this sort of powerful culture intervention with something like the Rolling Jubilee, which was a call for a jubilee against debt, came out of the cultural industries. And many of them were, in fact, artists and art workers who no longer had work. And so I wanted to use those examples to begin the book to sort of situate what does it mean to be an artist who has to train through the university, but in training through the university becomes a kind of indebted worker who now considers that debt as part of the conditions that, you know, he, she, or they will be using to produce the art.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And I think this takes on a completely new relevance right now during the pandemic, because art schools, of course, continue to educate student artists while it remains completely unclear whether the types of practices that they are being trained in will remain relevant when they graduate. And of course, at the same time, artists are being compelled to continue practicing and producing. It's a kind of an imperative, you know, publish or perish, or rather exhibit and produce or become irrelevant. And artists are also perversely, I think, are the ones being charged with finding creative ways to overcome the very crisis by which the industry is being consumed. So I think in a way we're facing a situation where we have supply and we have demand, but we don't have a clear way of matching the two under what we understand as traditional institutional structures.
Yeah, I mean, the book, I try to sort of weave a narrative through the book. So we were just talking about chapter one, in which I sort of set the conditions for what does it mean to train as an artist in the United States, particularly a socially engaged artist? How did those conditions get to be the case? And then where do you go once you have sort of graduated, you've gotten your credential, you've gotten your debt? And yet it's unclear that there are institutions or institutional spaces commensurate with the number of artists who would like to be participating in those spaces. Chapter two, then, is about artists who feel the need to make their own institutions. And I think this is something else that we notice in the early 2000s or early aughts up through the 2010s is a proliferation of artists sort of saying, okay, there are no institutional spaces of the kind we trained to exist in and to circulate them. So we're going to have to start making our own institutional spaces. And those institutional spaces will, on the one hand, be artistic spaces. And on the other hand, they will be our art, right? So there's really an expansion of what it means to have a sort of art installation or art situation when it comes to an art project can now be a multi-year institution involving multiple people. But at the same time, you need to have a population to fill those institutions. And I think now we enter into a sort of space that someone like Claire Bishop has certainly noticed in her work on socially engaged art, where she sort of asks, you know, what's the relationship between socially engaged art and the proliferation of socially engaged art and the waning of the welfare state, right? So a welfare state might do something like provide medical care. Again, the current moment of the pandemic really frames that lack quite starkly, I think. It might provide education. It might provide social services. And what I really took from Claire Bishop and her work, Artificial Hells, is that a lot of socially engaged artists make social infrastructures of the kind that a welfare state might make were there a welfare state. All they do so as art, which, what does that mean? They don't do it as scale, right? So one of my favorite examples of this is by an artist named Zachary Gao, who did a piece called Dentistry at the Museum, in which he brings a mobile dental clinic to a museum in Portland, Oregon. So you know, in the United States, obviously many people don't have health insurance, but even fewer people have dental insurance. So there's a crisis of teeth, right, to add to our list of crises, and a crisis of dental care. So his socially engaged art project was to offer dentistry at this museum. But of course, not for very long and not for that many people. And that's one of the differences between a socially engaged artwork and a social welfare institution, the scale at which it operates. And one of the things that artists have begun doing in their building of these sort of para-institutions to engage a social welfare-like lack in a sort of contemporary capitalist society is doing what, you know, reformers and social engineers and liberators have been doing for hundreds of years, which is trying to incorporate children into these spaces, right? There are sort of multiple reasons why socially engaged artists start to show up in public school. And you know, those are also very interesting, and they're also indicative of our current moment. One is that, schools used to have art programs. They used to have an art teacher. In the United States, mostly that is no longer true. Instead, a school will invite a socially engaged artist to come in and do something as their artwork with the children for a small amount of time. That's problematic in itself, right? If my critique, which is what it, you know, in the book, my critique is that socially engaged art is trying to claim a space to critique and understand the relationship between art, labor, and economy and our current moment. And one of the effects of that is that more often than not, the artist gets portrayed or portrays themselves as an uncompensated worker, which they are. Then how do we account for children in that scene, right? What is a child? And one of the larger theoretical debates that I try to engage in every chapter in the book, and what to me seems really sort of our two contemporary perspectives for understanding the economy, is the sort of neoliberal perspective and the kind of Marxist perspective, right? And I don't even mean neoliberal as, in a sense, a proactive term. I mean it as a sort of critical term, right? Like, should we understand an artist, to use your own language at the beginning of the interview, should we understand an indebted artist as somebody who is, quote unquote, made a bad investment in themselves? That's really to adopt a certain neoliberal idiom. Or should we understand them as somebody who is unwaged, who does not have labor to sell? That's to adopt a much more sort of Marxist idiom. And children don't necessarily fit into either of those schools, those theoretical schools, right? I'm talking to you from London. I mean, London has quite a history of, you know, child labor, as you know. But for the most part, it's in the global north, we no longer have children working. It's true, we have them working throughout the world, but mostly in capitalist democracies of the global north, children are not allowed to work. In the United States, they have not been allowed to work since the 1930s, since 1938. At the same time, we can't really speak of children as debtors or as people who are making their own investments, right? What does it mean for an 8-year-old to invest in themselves? But certainly the neoliberal economists were very concerned about the kind of investments that society makes in children. And so someone like Gary Becker has a wonderful article called The Quantity Versus Quality Theory of How Many Children to Have, where he tries to parse, like, is it better to have more children and give them fewer resources, or fewer children and give them more resources? What is the sort of equilibrium moment for this? So what I was wondering is, given this sort of disparate history that I've just mapped out, where you have socially engaged artists in schools, and given these theoretical perspectives, which don't necessarily include a role for children, what do we make of the fact now that multiple socially engaged artists include children in their artworks, right? And one of my favorite pieces that I write about in that chapter is from the the Canadian arts group called Mammalian Diving Reflex, and they do this piece called Haircuts by Children, where they actually sort of ask us to critique our own bourgeois sentimentality of a child can't be paid, a child can't work, a child is a sort of protected class. And as their artwork, they enfranchise children to become workers, but only for a moment, right? So I'm really trying to sort of critique what is the boundedness of the child as a potential worker, as a potential debtor, and how do they circulate in art pieces to expose each of that type of boundedness?
Well, this is something I very much appreciate about the book. I think that by bringing children into the equation, you produce a situation where we can catch certain boundaries and links between the worker as an economic subject and the wider capitalist system in a way which we would probably otherwise not be able to examine. And I think there's an inherent difficulty otherwise in understanding an artwork's parallel aspirations to critique a set of conditions and the artwork's desire to alter these conditions and the artist's desire to benefit from such an alteration themselves. And it strikes me that art probably isn't the only discipline in which this kind of paradigm of work without a worker plays itself out.
Absolutely. But I really think, you know, and when I talk about the book and what one of the parallels I often make is to professional sports. I think it's a very interesting analogy, right? For multiple reasons. One, because professional sports dominated by decommodified labor, right? You go to a professional golf event or a basketball event or a tennis tournament, football, the Super Bowl, the majority of the people, quote unquote, working there are volunteering. You volunteer and you get selected to work at these places. So the whole thing is this sort of skeletal crew of decommodified laborers hoping to get a peek at, you know, Tiger Woods or Serena Williams or what have you. But the difference is sports has an amateur and community quality to it that art has at certain points had, like a community theater, art event, right? But that the sort of professionalization of art, particularly in the United States, has started to efface, right? So a sort of extended example, you know, if I, as a writer, decide to take up tennis and, you know, pay for a few lessons and start playing on my public courts, no one is there telling me, you know, keep it up. You might be the next Serena Williams. Like, it could just be around the corner. You know, it's like, no, Serena Williams is Serena Williams, and there cannot be that many of her, right? It's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen for most people. But in arts education in the United States, like, you're going $100,000, $150,000 into debt. Yeah, you want to hear that you're going to be the next or whoever it is. And that fiction has to be operative, right? Now, if that educational structure were different, if it were, you know, you're participating in community theater, a community art space, a community art show, there's no hope of professionalization. This is not a site of professionalization. This is not going to be a site of wage labor. This is something else. It doesn't mean that it's not serious, that it's not enjoyable, that it can't proliferate, that it can't be critiqued, right? But the professionalization of artists in the United States at the level that we've seen since the 1970s has led in a direction of indebtedness and disenfranchisement.
Right. See, what I find valuable in your characterization here is that it does not rely on references to the forces of the art market. And in that, it avoids relying on this most obvious manifestation of capital as this kind of one-size-fits-all bogeyman. I think in the book you paraphrase Adorno in stating that an artist is essentially a poor person with social capital, right? But then we do have this problem that when the social capital could maybe, just maybe, be in some way exchanged for real capital, that is the capital of the art market, even if that's not a prospect in reality.
You know, I think the art market, it's such an interesting question. you're right to ask about it, because it sort of hangs over the book as a kind of specter of, is this a different art world entirely? Is there a relationship between the kind of artists that I write about and somebody like, for example, Richard Serra, who I write about briefly in one of the chapters? Can we even talk about an art market? You know, in the United States, there's a critical university studies scholar named Mark Busquet, and he riffs on this phrase often, the job market. So when PhD students graduate, they're told that they're going to spend a few years, quote unquote, on the market, right? And that it's a job market. And he says, this is a total fallacy. There is no market, right? As though there were a place where if you get a PhD, particularly in the humanities, right, there's a site that you might go and sell your wares and someone might be there to buy it and you might negotiate a kind of price as though we're an Adam Smith, you know, back in the Wealth of Nations. Because it doesn't exist. It's not, it is not there. It's not real. And I think that the quote unquote art market, you can probably make a similar case for. I think that, and I don't have research on this. This is more sort of circumstantial evidence and hearsay. But I think that aside from the blue chip galleries, I think many galleries are run as sort of pet projects and art projects in themselves. And people don't hope to make money from them. They hope to foster a community, right? And people hope to meet other people and to allow a space for work to flourish and to allow a space for criticism to flourish. Why is that couched in the terms of a potential art market? I think that's already indicative of a larger problem. Now, I think at the elite levels, where you can speak of a global art market, then you also need to speak of things like currency exchanges and money laundering and all the rest of it, right? I mean, then we're talking about a kind of high financial world that I think is quite removed from the immediate concerns of the book. And I think certainly at its best, that's one of the things that socially engaged art can do and must do, is really provide a sort of language and an idiom and a sort of visual and material iconography in which to criticize even the idea of the art market. I think that needs to happen. I think in a lot of the work I look at in the book, the artists try to produce that and in some cases really do, and I think do a wonderful job of criticizing it. At the same time, the language of the quote-unquote art market does not just come from artists and art institutions. I mean, it's the language that saturates our present, and it's very hard to completely disarticulate oneself from such a hegemonic language and way of speaking. And I mean, you know, these terms that, you know, they seem quite picayune and non-important, something like stakeholder or our brand or accountability. I mean, they're just a set of horrible terms that come out of 1970s neoliberal economics that somehow in the United States, at least, people who really should know better, like, you know, left-wing magazines and left-wing commentators and people in universities have adopted this and tried to use this as a critical language to talk about our contemporary state of economic affairs. And we need a new vocabulary. We need a new vocabulary to have that kind of conversation. And I do think that that's what these socially engaged artists are trying to do. What I hope my contribution to that vocabulary is to say we need to specify what kind of labor is subtending and maintaining those institutional spaces. And that's precisely decommodified labor.
I want us to go a tiny bit deeper into the problem of language and complexity. In your previous book, Scandal and Obstruction, you described the way in which the language of finance and markets, which is, of course, very jargonistic and impenetrable, is the very thing that makes finance a complex and therefore autonomous discipline. This is of interest to me partly because of my own research that looks at how art interacts with knowledge systems of other disciplines, but even more so because in one of my former lives, I used to work in the financial services industry. And my experience there was that once one gets through the door, the whole thing becomes actually very easy. And I mean that it's easy to perform, but it's also easy, in a sense, to critique on its own terms. And in that light, the linguistic tendency towards impenetrability at the disciplinary perimeter is very counterproductive and troublesome. So I wonder if there isn't some kind of a capitulation that we can identify here.
I think it's a great, question. And I'm really glad that you included in that question the fact that for those of us or for those of you who work in financial services and investment banking, the language of complexity and impenetrability and obfuscation does not saturate your daily work lives, right? When you're putting together a derivative contract and selling it, you know precisely what it is, right? I think it's such an important point. I mean, the whole world is complex. You know, cancer is complex. The coronavirus is complex. Plenty of things are complex. The question is, when does the genre, when does the language of complexity become so all pervasive that it can sort of stand alone? And for me, in an article that I wrote called The Rules of Abstraction, which was trying to track this question of how did finance come to be seen as complex, what one of the sites or one of the moments where I would say it becomes hegemonic is when it's used to both propagate and criticize the object, right? So in the wake of the 2007-2008 global credit crisis, you had the bankers and the industry and the government, you know, all the sort of actors of that crisis, enabling it, profiting off of it, producing it. They were all using the language of complexity, right? At the same time, you also had critics of that. And I'm counting someone like, at his most popular, someone like Michael Moore, a sort of gonzo progressive journalist in the United States, or multiple academics. I mean, I hear this all the time at academic conferences. You have academics also using the language, saying, well, how can we engage this as academics, given that it's so complex? So there's a moment where the situating of the idiom and the situating of the language stops and breaks down. It's accepted as given. Then it becomes hegemonic. Then it becomes much more difficult to criticize in a kind of free-flowing and engaged way. Then you have to start producing a history of the terminology itself, even getting to the point of having a conversation about it, which is, you know, necessary. That's what academic knowledge is.
Well, to get back to Wages Against Artwork, in your next chapter, which is entitled Artwork Animal, you potentially offer a way to bypass languages altogether. It's a step on from the idea of children art workers, which you discussed in previous chapter. And yet you open this discussion with an incredibly charged image of a work by the artists Sun Yan and Peng Yu, in which we see two aggressive dogs chained into a pair of treadmills in such a way that they cannot attack each other, even though it's clearly precisely what they want to do.
You know, it's funny. We talked about at the beginning of the interview, we talked a little about the organic development of the book. And I said I first came to this book by looking at artists in debt and then looking at artists sort of creating their own para institutions. And, you know, as I was in New York and going to galleries and going to show like Brooklyn Crossing, which is a big show about socially engaged art that took place at the Brooklyn Museum in 2014. It was just a sort of, I just noticed there are so many birds in galleries now. I mean, we've passed the taxidermy point, right? That was maybe like a 1990s kitsch aesthetic, early 2000s. Now it's like in the work of Mark Dion or Duke Riley, who I write about, or the artist you just mentioned, they're actual animals. Right? I mean, it started with birds, but then once you start to notice, there are animals everywhere. And there was a restaging of the Yannis Kounellis, his wonderful piece, the untitled 12 Live Horses. And this was just a sort of genuine moment of question and revelation for me when I just asked myself, I was starting to work on a book about unwaged artists. And I had this question, why are there animals everywhere in contemporary art? And then the answer just dawned on me, oh, it's because they can't be paid, right? You cannot pay an animal. If you want to, you can't pay an animal. They don't seem to have recognizable systems of payment of the type that we would know how to interact with. So there was a just sort of immediate representational concern of, okay, the animal stands in for the artist who can't be paid, right? But while the artist can make a claim on his or her own non-payment, the animal can't really do that, right? So the animal becomes its own sort of obscure device for existing in the gallery space to represent multiple sites of non-payment, not just the artist, but probably the person who owns the gallery, probably the interns, probably the art students. I mean, there's a whole network of non-payment. There's a whole network of decommodified labor that exists that it seems to me that the animal was coming to stand in for. At the same time, in criticism of these pieces, particularly something like the Yannis Kounellis piece, which, you know, put on by Gavin Brown, a big blue chip gallery, it got a lot of attention. The animal itself was being referred to as an artist, right? And sometimes even an art worker. So you have the actual art workers who can't be paid attending to an animal in a gallery who has no possibility of payment. The gallery conditions of the worker and of artwork are not really being described, and yet the animal has been transposed into an art worker who can't be paid for an entirely different set of reasons. And it just, it seemed like such a rich confluence of theoretical problems. And it's also the chapter in which I think I am able to really use the animal to criticize and try to resituate what Marx meant in his development of the concept of labor, right? That's certainly one of the terms that has been most motivating for me as a writer, as a critic, in works of literature, and certainly in looking at works of arts, right? What is labor? What produces value? What produces surplus value? What does it mean to work? And one of the things that I'm really proud of that I think I do in the book is, I think it's an important part of my methodological process. I try to really distill what a concept is, and then I try to show what the limits of that concept are as that concept circulates in different spaces. And for Marx and for Marxism, an animal cannot be a laborer, right? They don't sell their time. That's for Marx what it means to be a laborer. It's not that you sell your energy. It's that you sell yourself for a certain period of time to somebody else. And that is time which, on the one hand, you can never get back. On the other hand, you then have to find your own time to regenerate yourself to return to work the next day. That is an economy that an animal does not participate in. And I tried to use that juxtaposition to show the limits of what artistic labor can be taken to be in a Marxist concept. And in the book, that's something that I hew very closely to. So I come down in the chapter on animals in the book where I say, we can't call these animals art workers, even though they are in art and are representing work. That does not a worker make, right? And this is a very long conversation in Marxism. You know, in the 19th century, right, can you consider slaves workers? They're not waged. At the same time, they clearly produce surplus value. This is a conversation that Silvia Federici is having and other Italian feminists in the 1970s. What is housework? It's not wage, but it clearly assists in social reproduction. And I think that animals sort of offer a new instantiation of that. They can't work, but they also can't be put in debt. And in that sense, they're very similar to children. And we also often find these two grouped together. So that's the chapter for me that I think, on the one hand, was the most engaging to write, because I myself love animals and love to look at them. I'm, you know, sort of a Philistine in that way. But on the other hand, I think I almost feel the most distance from that chapter now, because I think I've maybe rejected some of the claims that I myself make in that. Not rejected, but I don't know how helpful they are, right? I don't know how helpful the kind of categorical critique that I provide in that chapter is.
Well, all the same, I know for a fact that this hasn't deterred you from engaging with the animal kingdom as a practical theoretical lens.
Yeah, I'm working on a new book now that's called Marx for Cats, A Radical Bestiary, which is a history of capitalism from its you know, sort of feudal prehistory, I would guess, into its sort of early colonial and merchant capital moments through its Keynesian and financialized moments. That the history of capitalism only narrated through how cats appear as figures of both critique, but also as figures of a kind of propagation of a certain form of capital. So for example, you know, I'm talking to you from London. Great Britain as an imperial power has made ample use of the lion for hundreds, if not over 1,000 years, depending on how we want to construct the genealogy. But of course, workers' actions against employers, against imperial powers, are often referred to as wildcat strikes. So the book is a compendium of images and stories and political economists writing themselves in which the cat functions as a critical figure. But the project itself had its genesis with one of the artists I write about in Wages for Artwork, Caroline Woolard, and another artist named Orzu Balski. And we were talking about one of the things that I feel quite proud of about the book and that I really enjoy hearing is when artists say, they say, as artists, we need to have more of a vocabulary and more of a conceptual familiarity with the kind of economic terms that you present in the book. And would it be possible to have a kind of glossary of them? And I appreciate that. It seemed like not exactly the kind of project I wanted to work on. But then I think it was Caroline Woolard suggested, she said, well, what if instead we did a series of lectures about Marx's key terms, but you gave them to cats, right? She's everyone loves cats. And so we decided to just sort of try it. And it turned out that the cats absolutely loved the lectures. And in certain key moments, like Marx's writing on the class wars in France, you know, the cats started fighting each other when I'm talking about class war. So they seem to have a kind of interest in the material itself. And we did a series of videos, me lecturing to the cats, what is finance capital? What is labor? What is alienated labor? What is surplus value? What is a bourgeois democracy? Why is the bourgeoisie the most revolutionary class? And people were quite interested in it. But video and film is not my métier. So I just started to explore, would it be possible to turn this into a kind of artist book or a kind of book-length treatment of the relationship between Marxism as a critique of political economy and the cat as both a symbol of empire in terms of the lion or a symbol of sort of fierce revolt in terms of the tiger, or a series of refusals to work in terms of the wildcat. And it's developed into its own kind of sprawling project, which starts in the 9th century, or actually the 8th century AD, with Charlemagne in what is today France and Germany, sort of reconstituting a post-imperial transnational space in Europe through his use of the lion. And goes really up until our contemporary moment of, you know, the pussy hats that greeted the Trump presidency and the pussy revolts, you know, but also all of these arcane financial terms. So in finance, when traders are trading and they realize that a stock is going to drop quickly, but it's not a real drop in value. It will quickly come back. It's called a dead cat bounce, right? Or we have the Asian tigers as leading the sort of global economic formation in the 1980s and 90s. So it's an exciting book, but it's a book that I think makes use of animals, not, I don't know that I would still say as laborers, but certainly as comrades and colleagues, right? And in that sense, I think the book is a little bit at odds with the chapter on animals and wages against artwork, where I really sort of toe the Marxist line. Whatever it is that animals are doing in socially engaged artwork, it's not work because animals don't labor. That's not the appropriate category for them. And I think this also functions, hopefully Marx for Cats will function as a sort of critique of Marxism and Marxist political economists per se it, you know, why is it important to have that species boundary? What do we get from it, right? But also, what shape should criticism take, and should what kind of pleasures and entertainment should criticism offer? You know, can criticism be fun? I mean, Marx himself was a quite funny writer, and I don't pretend to have his literary gifts, right? But I think there's a question in the contemporary academy of, you know, so many people in the academy work as adjuncts, so many people train for jobs that don't exist, the debt it produces, the misery it produces. What do we get out of sustaining these conversations, and who are they for, right? And I think what I'm trying to do in Marx for Cats is hopefully enlarge that audience, but also enlarge what criticism could be, right? And really think about criticism as a project of joy and humor and fun and pleasure, which is quite anathema to many Marxists, you know, for many decades. I mean, not all, but many.
Well, we'll certainly be applauding your endeavor to expand audiences for Marxist criticism to cats, and perhaps you even find a whole new mission for the academy and maybe even for art.
Well, we'll see. We'll see about that.
Well, I just have to reassure our listeners who might be finding this project as amusing as I do, that it is indeed a serious enterprise, even if I spent all of last night watching cat videos. I'll include some links in the show notes, and I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend them.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Well, there we have it, a case for working with children and animals, if we ever heard one. Lee Claire, thank you so very much for joining me on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Lee Claire LaBerge's book, Wages Against Artwork, is published by Duke University Press. I'm Pierre de Lancet. Join us next time.